Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. On June 25th, 1950, somewhere between 75,000 and 135,000 troops of the North Korean People's Army swarmed across the 38th parallel. They caught the South Korean army flat-footed, almost completely overwhelmed them in the early stages of that conflict. In what would become the United Nations' first test, 16 nations sent troops and 41 sent equipment or other aid. 5 million soldiers and civilians lost their lives during that war. The price in blood for the United States, 36,574 killed, 103,284 wounded. An astounding 7,747 Americans still unaccounted for from that war. Korea was also the first conflict of the Cold War, with all the major powers left standing after World War II playing a hand, the Soviets and China on the North Korean side, and the U.S., Britain, and France allied with South Korea. Despite the amazing number of casualties and the impacts it had on future global relations, sandwiched between the destruction that was World War II and the social political upheavals that were associated with the Vietnamese War, Korea is considered by many the forgotten war. Well, we're not going to forget it. We haven't forgotten it. So today on American Warrior Radio, we have three veterans of that era, two of whom saw combat in Korea. We've got Navy, Air Force, and Marines represented here in the studio. Let's get right into it. Let's start off with Wally Howard. He's a chapter commander for the Arizona Korean War Veterans of Pima County. Wally, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you.
Now, you were Navy, then Marine, correct, Wally?
My first enlistment was with the Navy from 1950 to 1954. 2 weeks after my discharge from the Navy, I joined the Marine Air Reserve out in Los Alamitos, California, for two more hitches, which gave me a total of 12 years in the military.
Okay, and what kinds of things, in terms of civilians would understand, what did you do in the Navy and the Marine Corps?
I was stationed on a destroyer, the USS Frank Knox, DDR-742. Our primary job in Korea was surveillance, radar, and just general backup for shore gunnery if needed.
Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing I've read, and I tell you what, I've got three experts here, so normally Ben gets one dumb question a show. I'm gonna ask you. Let me have a couple of dumb questions here, fellas. But the nature of the Korean conflict, Wally, they did not have a Navy, right? So there was not a lot of naval combat in Korea, or, I mean, actual shooting stuff other than shelling?
Most of the Navy activity around Korea was a lot of the evacuations from the when the Chinese started pushing back down to the end of the South Korean peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get in any of that, but The Frank Knox was there for a lot of surveillance work, mapping, things of this nature. I don't think we must have fired more than a couple of dozen 5-inch rounds into shore. But we were kind of sitting on the fringes, you might say.
Sure. Playing an important role, though. I mean, now, the invasion of Incheon, that was a amphibious invasion, right?
Right. We weren't there. We were on the other side of the peninsula.
Okay. Well, lucky you, maybe.
Could be.
Now, Wally, tell us about the... I tell you, I feel very strongly about this, and you and I had commented offline about, you know, particularly young people nowadays, so many of them. You yourself said you ask a young person about Korea, and you kind of get this blank stare. They might not even be able to find it on a map. Tell us about the Korean Veterans Association, who you are and what you do.
Well, we are a national organization. We're headquartered in Illinois. Somewhat like the American Legion, we are divided into departments, each state being a department. That state is further divided into chapters. Mm-hmm. We don't call them a post. We call them chapters. Each chapter is then headed up by a chapter commander, a vice commander, secretary treasurer, sergeant at arms, and a judge advocate. Our particular chapter, we meet at the state veterans home on the grounds of the Veterans Administration at 6th and Ajo. And at present, we have 37 members in our chapter. And it, excuse me, I've kind of lost it for a second.
No worries. Now, I guess one thing I'd like you to comment on, that the Given the timing of the Korean War, as I understand it, 404,000 Korean War veterans also served in World War II before moving into Korea, and then another 273,000 would go on to Vietnam. What's your sense, Wally, of your chapter members, how that percentage works out? Where many, and we'll talk to some of our other guests here about what their experiences were, but do you see a balance, the same kind of balance with your members there of your chapter?
I'm not too sure what you mean by the balance, but I don't think we have but one who was a Second World War veteran also, and
okay.
I don't know of any of them that were Vietnam War veterans.
Okay.
So we're pretty much the Korea era in there. Most of us, of course, we're all in our middle 80s, and that pretty much puts us in the Korean time element.
What does the organization do besides provide a forum for you all to kind of stay in touch with each other? What other kind of programs do you offer?
Well, right now we have a project that we're pretty darn proud of, that we help a area here in Tucson called the Bravo Base, which is a mini military encampment made up of homeless veterans. It's behind Santa Rita Park. And we've sort of taken them on as a project to assist them in any way we possibly can. Matter of fact, we found out that the only car they had to transport their residents to and from the camp to the Veterans Hospital and to pre-employment interviews was about on its last legs. We managed to find a minivan in very good condition and donated it to them.
Wonderful. How many, I mean, that's a whole nother show, but how many veterans do you think are part of that Bravo camp that are?
I believe they average around 30 to 35 residents there at any one time, and some females.
Hmm. And from all eras, or mostly younger veterans probably, or?
They're from all eras, yes.
Okay, that's I'm sure you feel like maybe I do. That's just shameful. I know the mayor's got an initiative to really get all the veterans he can off the streets and into housing. So, what's your perspective? How well does Tucson do when it comes to that?
I think Tucson does a lot better than most cities that I'm aware of. Mayor Rothschild is behind this Bravo base, and I think he's visited a couple of times, and the gentleman who started this whole thing, a man named Lewis Arthur, has done a remarkable job in going out and finding veterans who are encamped out in the desert and bringing them into the encampment.
Okay. What if folks want to help out people who are not Korean veterans, can we kick in some money into the pot, or what can our listeners do, you know, whether it's here or whether they're listening around the country? I assume they could check in with their chapter in another state.
Well, Bravo Base does not, I emphasize not, accept money. They do accept gift cards, clothing, food, just about anything that is still usable. And what they can't use, they make sure that other homeless people, whether they're veterans or not, can use this stuff, and they distribute it out.
Okay. Well, folks, that was Wally Howard. He's the chapter commander for the Pima County chapter of the Arizona Korean War Veterans. He's going to stick around. We're going to hear from him more later. Did you know that the very first jet-to-jet dogfight occurred during the Korean War on September 8, 1950? Air Force Lieutenant Russell Brown flying an F-80 Shooting Star downed in MiG-15, piloted by a North Korean. We're going to hear from the Air Force when we come back. Joining us in studio, we've got Chuck Hudson, who was with the United States Air Force in-country in Korea. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back. Just a wonderful musician, excuse me, out of Nashville, very supportive of the military. Kurt, thank you so much for allowing us to use your song, Semper Fi. Whenever we've got a Marine on, you can find out more. Visit Kurt Stacy, that's STACY.com. The reason we played that is typical. The Air Force guy says, I'm not ready. Talk to the Marine. So I'm just busting your chops. See, you know, it's okay. So we're going to kick it to our Marine guest today. His name is Lacey Bethea. He was a gunnery sergeant in the United States Marines. He entered the Marine Corps on October 4th, 1946. Lacey, I understand that you began in supply, but then you became, so we have two ammo guys here today.
Yeah, I was the Admiral Sergeant and Battalion Armorer in 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, and in the 1st Marine Regiment. And our commanding officer was none other than Colonel Chesty Fuller.
Oh, my. That's a name you should recognize.
He was quite a man, and he got to know everyone that worked for him. And he generally walked around and said, "Good morning, old man. How are you?" And your answer was, "Just fine, Colonel. Thank you." And that was the way it was with him. Now, he was, as soon as he walked in, you were in his presence, you just felt his command presence mm-hmm. and how he could, I don't know exactly how to say it, how he could support you with just by being there. As soon as you looked at him, and that we had a lot of Marine officers, just as soon as you looked at him, you knew that you could come out on the other side of the battle.
So inspiration and morale.
Oh, yes. He exuded inspiration and everything else. And when you looked at him, you knew that he had everything under control. And his men did. And sometimes you could call him Chesty and get away with it, but you didn't do that when there are a lot of troops around.
Sure,
but
sure.
On one-to-one basis, I made a mistake when I first met him of calling him, "Oops, you're Chet." And that's the way I started out. I said, "Oh, you're Colonel Fuller." And he said, "Yes." And then he said, "Oh, man, how are you?" And I said, "Just fine, Colonel." And so we talked a little bit about where I was from, and we talked about some people I knew who were in World War II for my hometown, and some relatives, and he knew of them.
Hmm.
And we talked quite extensively several times, and well, he had a business to do, and he had the business of running the regiment, and he ate rations just like we did, and he didn't come up with lots of fancy meals for his breakfast, dinner, and supper. Mm-hmm. He ate the same ration we did, and on his uniforms, even on his dress uniforms, the emblems he wore were the emblems the enlisted men wore.
Hmm.
And the officers had a different Marine emblem, and some of the officers wore them. But when you worked for him, and if you were an officer, you generally wore the enlisted Marine Corps emblems.
Now, Lacey, part of the reason I mentioned inspiration and morale, because luckily Wally brought you in here, and we're very fortunate to have you. You were one of the chosen few, and that's spelled, folks, C-H-O-S-I-N, which is literally the Japanese version. Don't get me started, but basically the chosen reservoir. The Chinese warned the U.N. not to cross the 38th parallel. President Truman dismissed it, and on October 1st, 1950, the U.N. forces crossed the 38th parallel, and just on November 25th, over several hundred thousand Chinese troops entered into the North Korean conflict full bore. One of the most, memorable is not the right word here, Lacey, but the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. I mean, you were there, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was sort of a surprise, but basically those folks, the Marines and I think some Army there, I mean, you were outnumbered 4-1 by Chinese troops, and you had to fight your way out. And 17 days and just bitter, bitter cold. I don't even know where to start that story, Lacey.
Well, it's hard to start it. The Chinese came in by wearing white uniforms, and they moved at night, and they laid in the snow and protected themselves as they could. But it was hard to see a white uniform against the snow. So they moved in at night, and we saw them We didn't see them until they were almost on top of us. And then when they attacked us, we were caught unawares and up to a point. But the Marine Corps had sent back to headquarters in Japan that we had run into Chinese soldiers. And they said, no, our intelligence indicated Chinese soldiers, and their Army intelligence says, no, they aren't here. But we have them.
Yes, sir, I got them right here. I'm shooting at them, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Now, what
yeah.
I mean, the North Korean Army was, when the war began, they were better equipped. They had Soviet tanks. The South Koreans didn't have anything. I mean, that's part of the reason I think that they just drove them south so quickly. But from your perspective, was there a pretty clear difference between the fighting capacity of a North Korean soldier versus a Chinese regular?
At the initial start of the war, there was a very considerable difference in the weapons that the North Koreans carried as opposed to the South Koreans. That was one of those things that came about after the war was over in 45, that the South Koreans were equipped, and not knowing too much about them, our government was instrumental in assigning them just enough weapons to get by, and they weren't so sure that the South Koreans wouldn't attack us. But we didn't know. Our government didn't know.
Yeah.
So they were equipped with limited weapons.
You know, hindsight's always 20/20, and I know I've seen some studies that allege that the CIA actually did see them moving south, but they said, oh, it's just a maneuver. We don't think they're actually going to cross the river. And unfortunately for you and your comrades, they sure did, and it ended up in a 17-day, just a pitched battle, pretty much everything thrown at each other. I read a quote where one of the commanders said, you know, if you run out of ammunition, throw a snowball at them, but make sure you put a rock on the snowball just so they know it's coming. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. We're talking about the Korean War. We'll be back with Lacey Bethea. He's a Marine gunnery sergeant, was at the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. We'll hear a little bit more from him. And also from our Air Force buddy who's here as well. He was ammo. If you're Air Force ammo out there, you know what that means. We won't get into it. But he was involved with part of the air war. I mentioned the first jet fighter dogfight took place during Korea. A lot of, I don't want to say innovations, but a lot of different things took place during the Korean War. When we come back, we'll talk more about the Chosin Reservoir. A photographer took an iconic picture during the battle there, and he asked the soldier of whom he took the photo, you know, Christmas is coming up, what do you want for Christmas? The soldier replied and reflected many of his comrades, which he says, just give me tomorrow. We'll be right back, folks. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Very proud to be joined by three Korean-era veterans here in the studio today. We're talking about the war. I won't call it a conflict. I'll call it a war because that's just straight up what it was. And particularly for two of the gentlemen here who were actually on land during that battle, that certainly resonates. We're going to go back real quick to Lacey Bethea. He's a gunnery sergeant for the United States Marine Corps, served in Korea, among other things, was at the Battle of Chosin Reservoir, one of the more brutal battles, if you could say any part of war is more brutal than the other. And then also jumping on board here will be our Air Force representative, Chuck Hudson, who served with the United States Air Force, also an ammo guy in Korea during the Korean War. So, Lacey, let's go back to you real quick, because here's Ben's dumb questions. I'm rapid fire. I've heard anything from 35 degrees below zero to 58 degrees below zero. How? I mean, one of your compatriots here was talking about the M1 thumb. You know, I mean, just trying to slam that magazine back into the rifle when your fingers are frozen. And you know, kind of, we've talked about some of the more practical ramifications of, you know, how does a fellow just relieve himself when it's 58 degrees below zero? I mean, I mean, you weren't just fighting the Chinese. You were fighting the weather, too.
Oh, yes. We were fighting the weather, and You know, the Fahrenheit thermometer is 32, it's freezing. And we were, a standard day was about 60 degrees below freezing. And it was difficult to do. You couldn't dig a foxhole.
Mm-hmm.
We used when we could get them out with the infantry troops, built kind of a hole above ground out of the rocks, and it somewhat protected us. But the clothing was adequate, but it was just too cold for that equipment that we had, our parkas and other cold weather equipment we had. It just wasn't quite enough, particularly when you were standing out there or laying out there in the snow or your hole. It was just miserable.
Now, you said that the Chinese had a propensity to attack at night as well. So not only was it cold, but you're at the peak of the cold, if you will, when you're doing combat in the middle of the night.
The Japanese, or the Chinese rather, would attack us at night, and they had a lot of bouncing, a lot of flares.
Mm-hmm.
And also they would wake us up and make it sound that they had a lot more men than they did. They had garbage cans and lids and beat on that, make a lot of noise when they did attack. They had some of the automatic weapons, rifles, that Russia had in World War II. And then our weapons froze. And the carbine we had was a little rifle, and it had a 30 caliber small cartridge, and it would just freeze up.
Mm.
And we couldn't get sometimes the rounds. You could see them go out about 50 yards and fall. So all of us used, all of the infantry used nothing more than M1 rifles. And to keep them thawed up, we had gallons of diesel fuel mixed with gasoline, and they just squirted it on the shooting mechanism of the equipment, and it did loosen up, and we were able to use our M1 Garands and our machine guns. But then in the vehicles, we had to run them 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be running mostly at night. And they generated a lot of noise, and sometimes we had to cut them down to see if anything was going on, and then we'd have to start them back up. But we had never, never experienced that cold weather, and that was the coldest winter that was ever in the Chosin Reservoir area. And the Korean name of the Chosin Reservoir was Changjin Reservoir.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese called it, was on the maps as being the Chosin. And that's what it's been since then. And if you mention Changjin, somebody will say, where was that? But
now remember, according to intelligence, the Chinese were never there, so.
Oh, yeah. they said the Chinese were never there, but we ran into them.
Sure,
and
sure.
You could tell, if you heard them talking, as compared to Korean was somewhat guttural, and the Chinese was some language and speaking was some like, it was a lyrical tone of voice, and it was sing-song. If you listened to it long enough, you could pick up the fact that it was somewhat sing-song as compared to the Korean, which was guttural.
Okay, Chuck, this is a good time to have you jump in. You were serving with the United States Air Force at the time, and don't take your headphones off, Lacey. We'll be going back and forth here, but you were working on aircraft, and was the weather as bad where you were, or what? I mean, what are the implications for the? I tell you, it's funny. I'm sort of joking that the Chinese weren't there. you know, the Russians also weren't flying those MiGs, were they? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
They weren't flying. They weren't flying the MiGs.
Yeah, Chuck. What were the implications for you as an Air Force, a guy loading up the aircraft?
Well, one thing, like you say, it was a good 40 below zero, and you'd have about a foot of snow, and guys were when we pulled guard duty, they'd come in and they're. Had one guy in my outfit, which was the 18th Fighter Bomber Wing, and this kid by the name of Coleman came. They brought him in a Jeep because both of his feet were frozen.
Oh boy!
And he couldn't even walk across the street to the clinic, to the Air Force clinic. They had to put him back in that Jeep and take him over there. That's how strenuous it was. And with my outfit, my outfit processed all the ammo for the 18th Fighter Wing. I got there basically at the tail end of the war to where Osan had... was the first concrete runway. Where they transferred from was down at a place called Chin Hay, and they had pierced steel planking for a runway and slept in tents.
Mm.
And as like they showed in the old, in that series MASH, you had to in a tent, you had right in the middle, you had the stove. If you turned it up to 3, you burned the place down. And if you turned it back down, you practically froze to death. So that was the extent of that. When I got there, they had progressed from the Mustang, the old P-51, which they redesignated F-51. They had to bring it in because the F-80 Shooting Star was not sufficient for close air support, and the Mustang was the best one they had, and they took practically every one they had, even in the reserve and the guard and everything else, brought them over there. And the 18th Fighter Wing had several aces.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was, like, I think most people knew, General Chappie James.
Yeah.
And, this what they called a police action. If it was a police action, how come all the cops weren't over there?
Yeah, good point. Now, was, by any chance, was Hoot Gibson with your group? Does that ring a bell?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Might have been.
Okay. Who was a good man retired here in Tucson?
I finished up in Korea, and I went back again 17 years later, and really it was completely different. And then I served, before that I also am a Vietnam veteran. I retired in 1973. I figured 22 years was long enough.
So you went from stinking cold to stinking hot.
Oh, yeah. Because I had stinking hot, you talk about,
yeah,
was my 2.5 years in Morocco at 140 degrees
above zero. Well, that's a tale for another time. Gentlemen, yeah, we got to take another break. When I come back, I want to touch a little bit when we come back about this whole issue about the equipment. You know, Lacey, you talked about the M1s. I also read that apparently we were so unprepared. Literally, you had armors at Fort Knox taking tanks down off a display and trying to gear them up again to send them off to Korea, and what a challenge that was.
Yes.
At the initial stage of the war. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, we're talking about Korea with 3 veterans who are there. Stick around. Don't miss it. We got one more segment coming back. back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. You know, time flies when you got a great guest in studio. Time really flies when you got three great guests in the studio. I've got three veterans of the Korean War joining us today. Lacey Bethia, who is a gunnery sergeant in the United States Marine. We also have Wally Howard, who's a chapter commander of the Arizona Korean War Veterans, and Chuck Hudson, who is a member of the United States Air Force, served in country during the Korean conflict. Gentlemen, conflict, I made that mistake, the Korean War. It was a war. In fact, you know, it's funny, Chuck, you said they call it the Forgotten War, and you said we sure as heck never forgot.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. A little bit of time here. I want to cover some stuff that you guys wanted to cover. Let's start with you, Lacey. You had some, you want to share a particular thought with us about, I think it was a Revisit Korea?
We have a Korean government several years ago. They started a program, Revisit Korea. And, if you wanted to go, you had to come up with a certain amount of money and the Korean government paid the rest. My wife and I went 2 years ago, and Korea was nothing more than an agricultural nation when we were there in 1950, 51, and 2, and 3, and there were rice paddies everywhere, and where there were rice paddies, there are now hotels or apartments, and Seoul is the capital city, and there are almost a million people or more living in all these, living in Seoul.
Mm-hmm.
And these Koreans have started eating American food, and they have increased in stature about 2 to 4 inches, and some of them are 6 inches. And then they put on some weight, and they look extremely healthy. And it was a pleasure to see these people, these Koreans, wearing American clothing. And they wore American clothing, and we saw very few traditional clothing, and those were mostly for theaters and operas and things like so.
Lacey, what, when they found out that you were a veteran that, that fought in country, what kind of reception did you get, or what kind of feedback would they give you?
That's so emotional, I can't begin.
Okay, okay, no worries.
I can't begin to tell you. They were so grateful, and everywhere we went, if we had a name tag, on it said we were did what we did, all of the armed forces, they would come up and shake our hands and say thank you. And these were kids. And they are I say elementary school kids, and they would thank us. And then we did a visit with, invited to the 67th year of armistice, and it was like our, shall I say, 4th of July, and they treated us like kings. And that's when we saw kids in traditional clothing. And then we found out, we went to a museum. Oh, geez, we need another hour or two.
I got plenty, but just not today.
Okay.
We'll have you back. Wally, why don't you swing the mic over there, because you're kind of leading off of Lacey's point there. You reminded me of the reason we were in Korea in the first place, and you can, you know, he touched on it now, and you can see it today in Korea of how they've become a very, very advanced, economically advanced society, and, you know, north of the 38th parallel, you got people still starving with no electricity.
Well, South Korea, since the end of the war, has developed into the 7th largest economy in the world. Like I said, they are the world's number one shipbuilders. Some of our finest motor vehicles are coming out of South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And the only other thing I'd really like to mention is I had the honor in April 2016 of going back to Washington, D.C. on what is known as the Honor Flight. and to visit the memorials in Washington. The Korean Memorial, while I was there, I was talking to one of the rangers, and I noticed that there's an awful lot of Oriental people there, and he told me that they come by the busloads from South Korea to see that memorial and to thank us for what we did.
Mm-hmm. Powerful stuff. And that's, you know, that's another reminder, folks. Honor Flight is just a wonderful program. We've had Colonel Moe and some other folks on there. And the reason I've got you guys here in the studio today is because of another Honor Flight big fan and supporter, Margo. Margo, if you're listening, thank you so much for arranging this for us here today. Chuck, any final thoughts on from your perspective on our discussion today?
Yes. You spoke about the economy now in South Korea. A good example, and I think Lacey will remember it, the main supply route. It was dirt when we got there. It is now, and I haven't been back since 1972. It is now, was then, an 8-lane paved toll road.
Oh, my gosh.
And if people remember the old Trailways buses, the Korean government has the buses that run with the hostess that serve you coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe it. The economy, there's a new book out called Korea Reborn. And it is free to every Korean veteran. It was done by the people of Korea. It is one way for them to thank all the Korean veterans for what they did. And I, in the near future, I have a couple of copies, and I'll give one to Ben so he can see the difference between when it started and what it looks like 1972.
Okay, well, gentlemen, thank you so much to each of you for what you did and your service to our country. Gunny, the Chinese came in. You guys pretty much broke their backs. They were not a factor much left in the war. Chuck, what's the Air Force attack? There you go. And of course, Navy, shipmate, thank you so much for being in here, Wally, and joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, another great show. People need to hear these stories. Visit AmericanWarriorRadio.com. You can find the podcast there. Share this with as many as people as you can think of. Folks need to hear these stories and repeat them so that the forgotten war is no longer a war that's forgotten. These three fellows didn't forget it. We shouldn't either. So once again, ladies and gentlemen, until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.